We certainly don't overlook the fact that you people have come, and I know she is grateful, and so are the rest of us. It's a fine that you would come out on a day like this. Arista Maria Sertatis is a member of the faculty of the Department of Government and Foreign Affairs at the university. She had her undergraduate work and master's degree work in history at the University of Washington, and her PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. Not only is she an authority on Poland, our principal subject this morning, and the countries of Eastern Europe, but she views them in a context that is reflected in the courses she teaches. Courses such as theories of revolution, social movements, state building in Eastern Europe, justice, crime, and political development, and European politics, East and West. In other words, in a very broad context against which to better understand what is occurring within Poland and other particular countries. This was apparent from the very first contact and association that members of the government department had with her in an excellent trial presentation she made when she was, before she was appointed to the government department. This broader setting probably is one of the best ways to understand the dramas of political leadership and revolution in Poland, and the topic of today, as you know, is the Polish Revolution in comparative context. She's had a number of awards, the Alexander von Humboldt Fellowship, an IREX Fellowship, International Research and Exchange Board Fellowship, two Fulbrights for research and study in Poland, and she's the author of numerous publications on Eastern Europe and Poland, including the book The Polish Solidarity Movement, Revolution, Democracy, and Natural Rights. It's a great pleasure to introduce her to you, and we all look forward to the discussion.
Thank you very much, and thank you absolutely for coming on such an inhospitable morning in many ways. I'm new to the area, obviously, and I'm just getting used to the summer weather here, the heat and humidity, and I must make a priori apology. I'm also suffering for the first time in my life some rather severe allergies here, which some of you are probably familiar with, and I'm just getting used to some of the medication involved, so it's a bit blurry sometimes, but I hope that that won't affect the presentation. I thank the Miller Center for having me here today. I've had the opportunity to attend several of the previous presentations on Poland, and I'm very happy to be able to make my contribution to the series. The focus today of this brief presentation is the question of what bearing Poland's rather unique history might have on the contemporary situation in Poland. Just by way of introduction, I'd like to review the contemporary situation and then introduce the discussion of Poland's history, specifically Poland's revolution, the revolution that Solidarity represented. Now, a lot of this information initially is probably somewhat familiar to you, but those of us who specialize in Poland and who study Poland are never tired of repeating the litany of recent successes that Poland has experienced. So you'll have to bear with me if some of this information is already familiar to you. But Poland is, without a shadow of a doubt, one of the most successful, if not the most successful, post-communist country, and the successes can be categorized in numerous domains or dimensions, starting with economics. Poland, according to The Economist, which tends to be my source for all things economics, since I'm not quite that specialized in economics, So I resort to The Economist upon occasion, and according to their review of Poland, the country has experienced 25% growth in the last decade. For the most recent years, from 1994 on, the country has experienced about a 6.3% increase in GDP annually, which is quite remarkable. This year, the prognosis and last year was not quite so solid, but the causes for that tend to be more external to Poland, namely the slowdown of economic growth in the European Union and the collapse of the economy in Russia, which has affected Polish exports. But Poland itself still maintains the same capacity for growth. The stock market, according to The Economist, is the best regulated and most stable stock market in Eastern Europe. As well, The Economist rates Poland's privatization scheme to be the most successful, more successful than the schemes of voucher systems of privatization that the Czech Republic introduced, and more successful even than Hungary's. Direct foreign investment in the country is quite significant and also holds steady. There have been no drops, instead a steady increase in direct foreign investment. Poland's debt load is manageable, as are its deficits, its budgetary deficits. Consequently, it has a very stable currency. The zloty does not fluctuate too greatly, nor does it seem to be vulnerable to some of these speculative runs on currencies which have caused such turmoil in the Asian economies. So consequently, when in summarizing all of these economic achievements, The Economist labels Poland to be the region's tiger economy, which is quite, again, quite nice for those of us who've lived in Poland and who study Poland to see that the country has, you know, achieved this status of being labeled a tiger. Socially, these economic successes have been reflected in the prevailing optimism. As some of the previous speakers have mentioned in this series, the Polish population tends to be the most optimistic in the region. Popular opinion polls have documented this from the mid-1990s on. Poland's population assesses overall the changes in the wake of communism's collapse very favorably, is very optimistic about the future, and has an overall positive assessment of what has been taking place in the country. This contrasts with the rather more negative assessments of the contemporary situation that you can find in Hungary and even in the Czech Republic. So Poland is certainly also the region's optimist, if you will. Socially as well, Poland's population, its citizenry, is very active. Poland has one of the highest numbers of non-governmental organizations in the world, actually, and certainly in Europe, for proportional to its population. So it is almost, one might say, a de Tocquevillian society, characterized by a propensity to associate spontaneously, for citizens not to wait for the government to do something, but to form a group, to form an interest group or an association to kind of try and take care of community matters on their own, rather than always waiting for something to be done by the authorities. And again, this is a very positive development. Politically, the country is characterized by a growing stability in the balance of powers between the three branches of government, so that Poland is basically, along with France, I'd say Europe's only working semi-presidential system, which is characterized, as you know, by a dual executive, a popularly elected president, but who serves or who shares executive powers with a prime minister that is appointed out of parliament. So what has worked in the Fifth Republic, surprisingly many people thought, that many political science especially thought that such a split executive, such a dual executive system could never work, the Fifth Republic has proven them wrong, and so too currently is Poland. It is a system that seems to be working, although there were some initial conflicts, of course, between the president, especially when Lech Wałęsa held the presidency, and the prime ministers, but that seems to all have been ironed out. So too has the electoral system. It's one of proportional representation. Initially, there were no barriers to entry into the parliament, so that parliament was very fragmented, many splinter groups, splinter parties. The Poles called them sofa parties because all of the members of the party could fit on one sofa. Well, these sofa parties have since, by and large, disappeared from the political scene as Poland has introduced a hurdle. It's not quite the 5% hurdle that Germany maintains. I believe at the last time I looked, it was 3% for a party and I think 6% for a coalition. That's the hurdle that they had to achieve in order to get into parliament. All of these economic, social, and political successes of the last decade have culminated in international recognition for the country. As we know, Poland is one of the three new NATO members, along with Hungary and the Czech Republic. It is also, along with these other two Central European countries, a member of the OECD. So it has the status of being considered an advanced industrial economy. EU membership seems ever more elusive and more problematic. It is still seen as somewhat of the holy grail for Poland and for the other countries as well in the region. But by and large, the rather more problematic prospects for EU membership have as much, if not more, to do with problems that are internal to the EU itself, rather than problems that Poland and the other countries might be having. Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary are working very hard to establish the criteria for membership in the EU. However, their efforts will all be wasted, by and large, if the EU cannot reform itself internally in order to prepare institutionally to accept new members. So that the burden of responsibility here, I think, largely lies with the EU. And finally, cultural achievements, which should not be overlooked. It was first feared with the collapse of communism that culture as a whole would suffer because the communist governments did maintain subsidies for cultural artifacts such as theater groups in small communities, orchestras in small communities, symphonies, things like that. Especially in the GDR, the East German population is very wistful about the loss of all of these very community-based cultural opportunities that had to be, of course, had to close down as the subsidies evaporated. Same thing happened in Poland, so there were fears in Poland that culture would simply be Hollywoodized, that the native and native traditions, native cultural achievements would simply be swamped by Hollywood movies and by bad Western European cable television programs. But these initial fears do not seem to have been borne out, at least in the case of Poland. In literature alone, Poland remains very active. According to my colleagues in the literature departments, according to many people, Polish literature is the most vibrant and exciting modern literature that is coming out of Europe and arguably the world. This has been reflected in two recent Nobel Prizes for literature, one that went to Czesław Miłosz in 1980, and one that went a few years ago to, I forget exactly whether it was 97 or 98, to Szymborska, a poetess. So altogether, this is a rather formidable list of achievements, and it certainly bears out the ranking that Poland has as being first, if you will, or the most stunning success of the region. Now, these successes, of course, should not overshadow certain problems that remain, and I'll just kind of briefly go over some of these problems. First of all, in the economic domain, here problems have emerged that in large part can be related or can be seen as caused by the tendency of Polish political elites towards economic nationalism. For example, foreigners are still not able to own land in Poland. There is a real fear that the national patrimony, the land, might all get purchased up or eaten up by, let's say, Germans. That's the greatest fear in terms of if you want to categorize who the Poles might be afraid of. So consequently, the legal system does not yet allow foreigners to own land. Now, that's something that they will have to change, especially for EU membership. Also probably caused by this tendency towards economic nationalism is the stalled state of privatization. Although Poland was initially very successful, especially in privatizing small retail trades and businesses and stores, and initially also was quite successful in privatizing large state-owned industries, this has recently come to a grinding halt. The state still owns about a third of the industrial sector or firms. The state still employs 40% of industrial workers. However, in spite of this size of this industrial sector that the state still owns, it produces only 5% of profits. So you can see that this is a very unprofitable ownership and management situation, which it would behoove the country to change, as soon as possible. And yet the state holds on to these industries. And in large part, it's, again, fear of having foreigners buy out critical industries, critical sectors of the economy. So Poland, for example, has been the last country to relinquish state control over telecommunications. Whereas Hungary and the Czech Republic rather quickly moved to privatize telecommunications, Poland is still hanging on and has only very recently begun the process of breaking state monopoly or state ownership of telecommunications, with the result that Poland, even though it is by far the most successful post-communist country, the tiger economy, has the worst telephone system in the region. And if you spend any time in Poland, you'll have this phenomenon, which I found absolutely remarkable, of telephones going dead after the rain. And when you try and find out, well, what's the reason why my telephone won't work? Well, the lines got wet. I mean, this is, the lines got wet. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let's moving right along. So it is definitely a primary basis upon which people run their businesses. You have to be able to send your faxes, use your computers, connect it to telephone lines, and even just basic telephones. And so Poland is clearly here in need of some improvements. So the hope is that this economic nationalism can slowly be eroded more rationally dealt with than it has been to date. Other economic problems are related to the uneven regional development. Certain regions in Poland are progressing much more rapidly, especially the old Habsburg territories are moving along at a rapid clip. If you go to the city of Kraków, which is in this old Habsburg area, it's indistinguishable from any other West European city. I mean, it is a beautiful city with wonderful restaurants and small boutiques. I mean, it is really a European city in every sense, in every good sense of the word. Yet this growth in this particular region of Poland, the kind of southeastern part of Poland, is not matched by similar growth in, let's say, the northwestern, that would be the southwestern part, now the northeastern part, the parts of Poland that border on Lithuania, and the parts of Poland that border on the Ukraine are not doing, or in Belarus are not doing that well. These are regions still, in some ways, almost stuck in another century, stuck in the last century. And so these uneven patterns of development are likely to be problematic in the future if they can't be evened out, causing frustrations, demands for redistribution, all kinds of problems that one might imagine. Socially as well, although there are more winners in Polish society than almost anywhere else in the region, there are nonetheless losers, groups in the population that have not been able to take advantage of the new opportunities and that have fallen behind, either because of their either because people are located in these regions that aren't doing well, or because they lack the requisite education or even access to education, to higher education, or by virtue of their age or perhaps other sorts of handicaps. There are certainly groups in Polish society that have not been able to take advantage of the recent successes. And this obviously also causes social strains and tensions and frustrations, which you can see having a political expression in the extent to which such groups are supportive of the strong kind of nativist, Catholic nativist rhetoric that is emerging. There is a branch of the Catholic Church in Poland that has taken on a rather well, it's familiar to American historians. I mean, we've gone through these periods of nativism, of hostility, of intolerance, and you can see a similar phenomenon taking place in Poland, unfortunately, somewhat under the auspices of the more conservative members of the Catholic Church. This kind of intolerant rhetoric of hatred and national supremacy, has been accepted by groups, obviously, that are on the losing side of the spectrum. It's because it provides a ready explanation for their own personal failures. You know, why haven't I succeeded in this new Poland, in this new land of opportunity? Well, it's because the Germans have held me back, or the Jews have held me back, or there's some great conspiracy at work that is preventing true Poles from benefiting from these new opportunities. No one questions, I mean, the good news in all of this is that no one really questions this structure of new opportunities. People in Poland don't want to move backwards. There are some people who would like to perhaps return to some of the social welfare nets of the communist period, but by and large, Polish society, even these more nativist elements, conservative elements, they don't want to move to the communist period. They may want to leapfrog back into a somewhat utopian, idealized version of pre-communist Poland, a Poland for true Poles. But they don't necessarily contest electoral democracy or capitalism or the market per se. They would simply like Poland to be more nationalistic the way it was under Pilsudski, under Marshal Pilsudski in the 1920s, perhaps. So perhaps, you know, a strong presidential leader dressed in a military uniform, those things, those types of symbolic reference points are attractive to this particular group of people. Politically, there have been problems in Poland with some political corruption, corruption that is mainly manifested in the tendency of political parties, once they are in power, to quote-unquote colonize the state bureaucracy, appoint their cronies, appoint their friends, appoint fellow party members to positions within the state bureaucracy, regardless of whether or not these people are actually qualified to fill these offices and these functions. In the case of Italy, this has been called, you know, the colonization of the state. And this has been a kind of a creeping problem in Poland, but it's been held within reasonable bounds has been bounded by the tendency of Poland to produce revolving cabinets. No party has been in power long enough to be able to thoroughly colonize the bureaucracy, and this is overall a very good thing. In large part, Italy's problems are due to the fact that the Christian Democratic Party was in power for so long. So the fact that Poland has these revolving governments, revolving cabinets, with parties going in and out of power, has actually been quite good, even though, again, it fuels popular frustration. people would prefer the stability. I mean, there are some, certainly some social groups who would prefer the stability of having just a firm leader. You know, just have, let's have one person up there that we can respect and that we can orient ourselves to, not this, you know, changing, ever-changing guard of unfamiliar faces. So again, there is perhaps a nostalgic yearning within some groups to return to the Poland of the 1920s and early 1930s. Politically recently, decommunization has become a burning issue in Poland with attending fears of a witch hunt, that if the kind of more nativist, conservative nationalists have their way, and if they did would have their way, then Poland would be a country that would be rapidly cleansed of all pernicious former communists. Certainly they should be wiped out of public office, and in this case that would include wiping out Poland's current popularly elected president, who was a member of the Communist Party himself. So if these nationalists, nativists, traditionalists would have their way, then all of these people should be barred from public office and should in effect almost be asked, you know, encouraged to leave the country. And so there is a potential for quite a witch hunt here, and this has been countered by the more liberal members of the former opposition groups, the former dissident groups, who say that what Poland should stand for today is tolerance and not not witch hunting. But it has been a very burning issue in Poland and politically quite carried on in very sharp language. The role of the church in public life is also still contested, hotly contested, and it seems to be at the moment that the church is backing off of public involvement and has restrained itself from, in the recent elections, for example, parliamentary elections, the church simply encouraged its parishioners to vote according to their conscience. The church did not, as in the past, actually tell people who to vote for and what political parties to vote for. So this is seen by many observers to be a good sign that the church is kind of backing off. Now, on balance, if you look at the problems versus the successes, I would say that the successes far outweigh the problems Poland is, I mean, the problems that Poland faces are in many ways quite similar to the problems that, say, a country like France or Germany or Britain might have. All of these three countries are also experiencing a rise in nationalist, you know, nationalist-fueled hostilities towards foreigners, towards immigrants, and have, you know, France has the largest kind of neo-fascist extreme political right-wing party in Europe. So it's a European-wide tendency, growing intolerance linked to higher levels of unemployment and declining economic potential almost automatically leads to these kinds of the kind of rhetoric of intolerance and parties that represent this rhetoric. So Poland is not somehow exceptional in this regard, that Poland has certain voices of nativism and nationalism is not exceptional. So on balance, then we can conclude that the successes of Poland far outweigh the ongoing problems, not that the problems should be ignored, of course. So how can we explain the success of a country like Poland and also the success of the Czech Republic and Hungary? Versus the notable kind of lack of success elsewhere in the region. Countries like Romania, Bulgaria, Albania are not doing as well, certainly, as these three other Central European countries. Now, in general, political scientists have given certain answers to the, you know, what determines winners and losers in the post-communist Eastern Europe, including a clear winner such as Poland, and they've pointed to things like prior liberalization under communism, pragmatic communist elites, Habsburg legacies, the legacies of a good administrative culture. Seems also to have some bearing on who succeeds and who doesn't in the post-communist world. Also, initial elections held after after the collapse of communism. In the initial elections, it is seemed to be important. Did the communists lose? Well, that paves the way for a whole range of reforms that then set the country on the path of success. If the communists, however, maintain power initially, as they did in Romania and Bulgaria, then that hinders the adaptation of necessary reforms. Consequently, these countries are still far behind. Now, in this list of possible explanations for what determines winners and losers in Eastern Europe, history, in particular, let's say, the unique history of Poland's revolution, Solidarity Revolution, doesn't play a significant role. And indeed, this is, by and large, the Polish view. This is the view in Poland itself. The consensus in Poland seems to be that any effort to analyze current successes in light of the history of Solidarity, the history of Poland's revolution, is simply nostalgia. You know, it's a kind of a nostalgia for the grand old symbols of Solidarity and the grand old movement loyalties, but none of this matters in the brave new world that Poland is facing now. Instead, people in Poland are attempting to trace the neoliberal roots in their history, you know, in order to replicate Western kinds of philosophical and policy traditions. You know, where's the Polish neoliberals? Well, let's go back in history and trace neoliberals in Poland. So there is, in effect, a kind of turning away from what is unique about Poland, from the unique achievements of Solidarity, in an effort to kind of trace a lineage of neoliberalism in particular that seems to matter more now. Now, this is not a view of Polish history that I share. I think the history of Solidarity matters much more than other attributes of Polish history, because Solidarity was one of the late 20th century's most meaningful expressions of democracy and was indeed a great democratic revolution. Now, in an effort to prove this, I undertook a comparative analysis of Poland's revolution, linking it to the revolutions in the United States and in France. And according to my analysis or my research, I found that Poland's revolution, the revolution initiated by Solidarity in 1980, had essential features in common with the American and French cases. Briefly, Poland's revolution was articulated in language that is very similar to that of the French and American revolutions, namely the natural rights doctrine, something that we are perhaps most familiar with in terms of Mr. Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, but you also find the natural rights doctrine articulated in the writings of Thomas Paine, and of course in the French case, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. It's very similar. If you analyze the language of Solidarity and you kind of place it in, you know, just place it alongside of the language of Mr. Jefferson or Thomas Paine or the French, you will find remarkable similarities. So the philosophy, the language that animated these revolutions was very similar. Secondly, this language was not just on the level of philosophy, but was lived and embodied in communities, communities in which people actually learned to behave like citizens, learned to treat one another in ways that were commensurate with this articulation of rights. And you see the same thing happening in the French and American revolutions. People came to see each other as equal citizens, being endowed equally with rights. And we have to, although we take it for granted now, we have to remember that in all of these cases, in all of these three revolutions, the social structure that these communities were rebelling against was one of strict hierarchy. There was no equality in there was some equality, and obviously more equality in pre-revolutionary America than elsewhere in the world, but there were still strict social hierarchies. Aristocrats were aristocrats, commoners were commoners, gentry were gentry, and so on and so forth. And even these hierarchies were even more apparent in the case of France, and they were apparent in the case of communist Poland. It was a different hierarchy, of course, without the feudal aristocracy. The role of the feudal aristocracy was played by the Communist Party. party elites. They were the aristocracy of that society. And the rest of society was kind of hierarchically organized beneath them. So within these communities brought to life during the revolution, whether it's the communities of solidarity or the communities of the American and French revolutions, revolutionaries began to live, to actually treat one another as equals. So the language of rights then is concretized in actual behavior in these communities. And again, I found sufficient similarities between the Polish and the French and American cases. And finally, it's kind of a tangential point, but it's something my advisor at Berkeley pointed out. You have in all three cases a remarkable constellation of leaders, of leadership. Certainly in the case of the American founding fathers, you have, in the case of Poland's solidarity leadership, a very nice kind of replication. I mean, one of the amazing things about American history is how did we end up with such remarkable men at this pivotal juncture in history? And the same, those of us who study Poland is the same thing. How did Poland end up with such a remarkable constellation of leaders at that particular point in history? Not just intellectuals, but also workers such as Lech Wałęsa or Zbigniew Bujak, who was head of the Polish underground solidarity and evaded police capture for numerous years. I mean, just remarkable people. And that is another kind of point of similarity. It doesn't have much analytical weight, but it's certainly in terms of description quite an amazing similarity. Poland shares more similarities with France than it does with the United States, having given you the general overview of the similarities. Poland's articulation of rights was more collectively oriented, just as France's was. So that you have less of an emphasis on individual rights and more of an emphasis on social rights or the rights of the group, the rights of the society. And this is true in the French articulation of natural rights as well. Both France and Poland also experienced a greater focus on substantive rights. In other words, rights that guarantee certain outcomes as opposed to providing equality of opportunity. And again, that distinguishes France and Poland from the American case. Much like France as well, Poland's revolutionary communities, even though they did bring the language of rights to life in behavioral terms, were very fragmented and conflicted. You had groups that were predominantly led by workers. You had groups predominantly led by intellectuals in Poland. These groups obviously came into conflict with one another. You had groups that were oriented towards liberalism, groups that were oriented towards nationalism, all within the solidarity framework. And consequently, there were numerous tensions and conflicts. And the same was true in the French case. In both cases, these conflicts were so great that they prevented a clear institutionalization of the revolutionary agenda. As we know, France, after its revolution, went to Napoleon. And after Napoleon went through about 100 years of different soft authoritarian types of regimes before finally solidifying democracy in the Third Republic in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Now, Poland, thankfully, has had a less tumultuous post-revolutionary experience and has moved rather quickly to a stable set of liberal democratic institutions. But it's still a failure in the sense that these liberal democratic institutions don't really embody the revolutionary hopes, ideals, and ethos that solidarity represented. Which was much more, if you will, oriented towards democratic socialism rather than neoliberal, liberal representative democracy. Certainly Solidarity valued these liberal representative democracy, but they hoped to infuse this liberal representative democracy with greater levels of participation, greater levels of direct democracy, and certainly a greater concern for the overall welfare of the working population. So that if we just want to put it roughly in European political terms, Solidarity had much more of a social democratic component to it than is currently reflected in the governing institutions of Poland. And that is a failure from the point of view of the revolution, of the people who drove the revolution. That is the reason, in large part, why people claim that solidarity does not have or has not had much of an impact on the events that or the processes that have been undertaken since 1989. The revolution failed to find its institutional embodiment. Instead, institutions from liberal democracy were simply established regardless of or in opposition to Poland's Solidarity's hopes and dreams. So that's why, in large part, analysts of Solidarity and Poles themselves believe that, yes, of course, Solidarity, the Polish Revolution, paved the way for the collapse of communism, in that it was the communist world's greatest popular upheaval. Indeed, it was, ironically, the working class revolution that Marx always dreamed about. But it was a working class revolution that was in opposition to a communist, so-called Marxist government. So this clearly paved the way for the collapse of communism, and the Solidarity elites also clearly paved the way for the introduction of democracy, of liberal democracy in 1989 by peacefully negotiating an end to the communist government in the roundtable negotiations. So that's kind of where people end the story and say, okay, Solidarity did those two great things and now it has no further significance. Now other events and processes have overtaken Poland. The language of neoliberalism is more important than the rhetoric or the ethos of Solidarity. So let's just move forward now. Well, I would argue that history still matters. The history of this great revolution still matters in Poland in determining the quality of the democracy that is being constructed now. And basically, because I know our time is running short, what I mean by that is that Poland, and so in the case of Poland, Solidarity, the revolution that Solidarity represented, still provides a symbolic and organizational point of reference for Polish citizens, especially those citizens who participated in the original movement. And just to refresh our memories, 10 million Poles were members of Solidarity. So this was an enormous social movement. And for those people who were members, who were movement members, Solidarity still has a symbolic and organizational significance. It is, in many ways, the ideal according to which current institutional realities are judged. And if the gap between the ideals represented by Solidarity and the institutions that are currently being built is deemed to be too great, then you see protest emerge. Polish citizens are among the most, if not the most, contentious citizens in the post-communist world. Now, forms of protest have been varied. You have strikes, workers going on strike, obviously farmers protesting poor conditions in the countryside, blocking highways, much as they do in France. Using very much the methods of protest, the language of protest, if you will, the whole pattern of protest inherited from Solidarity. The intellectual population, or the intellectuals or educated people who participated in Solidarity, are not likely to, let's say, go on strike or block highways. Their form of protest against current realities, or if, like I said, if the gap between their ideals and institutional reality is too great, they have chosen a different form of protest, one that is perhaps more constructively based, in that they have, again, shown a remarkable propensity to participate in public life through non-governmental organizations. The intellectuals of Solidarity are the ones that are propelling forward all of the citizens' groups, community self-help groups, local self-government. All of this is very much propelled by original Solidarity members. I've thought that the parallel was very nice, very similar to the state of California, where a lot of local community activism is driven by members of the, old members of the 60s generation. They don't want to participate in electoral politics. They're kind of jaded about, national politics, but they are still, have inherited or carry forward the legacy of 60s activism in their community lives, in their daily lives. And you see very much the same kind of, if you will, California model taking place. In Poland, intellectuals may may, again, be very jaded about national politics, be very kind of disappointed about the type of democracy, this kind of representative, delegative democracy that is being built in Poland, in other words, in which the electorate simply delegates power and authority to parliament and then steps away from public life. That's not a model of political participation that Solidarity bequeathed to this generation. Solidarity bequeathed a model of direct democracy. You know, take control, take responsibility, go out and do things. And this, so the highly associative nature of community life in Poland, I think, is a direct legacy or a direct inheritance from Solidarity. So in short, what you see developing in Poland, I think, and that is a direct consequence of its unique revolution, its and this embodied in Solidarity, is an active citizenry. Citizens that are willing to, as I said, take responsibility, willing to organize themselves, willing to do things outside of the scope of government. Now this, for us, you know, is kind of, well, that's business as usual. What's so, you know, what's so unusual about that? What's so special about that? Well, we as Americans tend to be far more privileged in this regard. This is our standard ideal of how a democratic citizenship should behave. But it is not the standard mode of behavior for democratic citizens in Europe. Europe tends to have a tradition, Europe East and West tends to have a tradition of a much more passive citizenship. It's citizenship that is linked simply to voting in elections. You vote in elections, then you know, in the elections, you delegate responsibility to the elites of your society, the best educated members of your society, and they then carry on the profound task of government, of statecraft. This goes all the way back in some ways to Hegel, and the German institutions of government were very much founded on this assumption. The state is simply too special a realm. Politics is simply too special a realm for ordinary people to participate in it. You have to have a law degree. You have to have the right background to be a legitimate participant or player in politics. Again, it's very much a European kind of tradition. And Poland has the potential, due to its unique history, its unique revolution, of breaking that tradition, of establishing something that is far more familiar to us as Americans, a far more participatory and active citizenship, a citizenship that does not simply vote in elections and then turn its attention to matters of consumption or production. Instead, a citizenship that remains involved in public life. And that is indeed, if this tendency towards an active citizenship can be strengthened in Poland, and if it proves to be continuous, then that will be Solidarity's most enduring legacy, I think, and a direct bearing. It's the direct link that you can trace from Poland's revolution to the state of Polish democracy today. So again, I hope I haven't tried your patience too much.
Mrs. Yuki?
Any foothold in Poland with an underground economy the way they have in Russia?
It's a very interesting question, and it's one that I'm deeply concerned about. What we know is that the mafia has some influence in Poland, but not as much, by no means as much as it does in Russia or Lithuania or the Ukraine. The mafia's influence seems to be linked to specific areas. For example, Warsaw has a very strong mafia presence. Kraków, on the other hand, does not. So it seems as if there is a mafia presence, there is an organized crime presence, but it seems to be limited and not growing. Which is good news, but it is a problem. A few summers ago, the Warsaw restaurants in the old town actually went on strike to protest having to pay protection money to the mafia. And this is, again, is a legacy of Solidarity. Rather than simply roll over and pay protection money to the criminals, These restaurant owners got together, again, very much like de Tocqueville would have, you know, written about in the case of the United States, got together, held meetings, and said, what can we do about the mafia infiltrating our businesses? And they decided to hold a public strike in which, for one weekend in the summer, they shut down the old town, closed all their restaurants, wrote a public letter of protest to Lech Walesa, who was president at the time. It was a huge media, the letter was published publicly in the media, it was a big event, with the result that the Polish government immediately tried to reform its police system and provide more adequate security for business people who were protesting or business people who wanted to escape the clutches of the mafia. This is not to say that the mafia was blocked at that point. It's, of course, still a problem. But the public is aware of it. The public is much more prone to fight the mafia in Poland than they are elsewhere in the region. And there have been some successes. The FBI now maintains an office in Warsaw. A few summers ago, I was in Warsaw walking down the street, and ahead of me, I saw this man who was dressed, very much like you would expect an FBI bureaucrat to be dressed. And I thought, no, wait a minute. I had this flash, like, am I in Washington, D.C., or am I in Warsaw? He had the squeaky shoes, the nice white socks, you know, the standard issue suit. And I kind of, at one point, he turned or something, and I saw he had a little ID tag, and he was FBI. He was actually FBI, and I kind of started talking. You're kind of far away from FBI headquarters. And he said, "Well, he's on a task force. He's there on a task force to help the Polish government develop both the legal mechanisms and the enforcement mechanisms that were, you know, we have established to deal with the mafia." So I would say that the outlook is optimistic due to the extent to which the Polish government and the Polish population are willing to fight the problem. But that doesn't mean that the problem is non-existent. It's significant.
George Barrow.
Thank you.
If we consider the strength of the Polish industry and the general situation in Poland, how do you think, from a plus and minus standpoint, when the European Union makes a strong effort to have them in, as they did in the Czech Republic and so forth, there are certain things that they would have to, I won't say give up, but have to participate with the European Union, and that is, there will be countries and companies in the European Union that would want to come in and participate as an ownership, mm-hmm. where up to now they can't. And the other thing, the European Union is working on a single currency. Mm-hmm. Would they be willing to give up their strong currency? Mm-hmm. And if so, how would it react to the voting as to whether they would accept the European mm-hmm. Union entrance? Mm-hmm. The European entrance now has all the countries except Great Britain. Great Britain hasn't accepted it, and they're going to wait for another 2 years.
Right.
But the euro has fallen somewhat in the strength of the mm-hmm. pound and the dollar and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that is basically because some of the countries in the European Union are the smaller countries which are taking rather than giving.
Right.
I just wondered what would be the decision on the pluses and minuses of joining the European Union?
It's a very interesting question. Initially, of course, for most of this past decade, membership in the European Union was, as I kind of mentioned, a holy grail for Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary. If we could just get into this club, then we'll have it made. Then we'll have all the benefits of the EU policies, and we will be protected. We will have access to the regional funds, the regional development funds, and all these lovely things that the EU provides for its members, for those countries especially that take out of the EU as opposed to giving into it. In the last year, there are growing concerns in Poland about EU membership. And so we are going to see the beginnings, I think, of a rather healthy debate over the pros and cons. Rather than seeing it as a cure for all, as it once was, I think now Poles, especially the educated public, the public at large, are going to do much more of a cost-benefit analysis. Giving up their currency or merging their currency in the euro, I don't think will be as much of a problem as some of the other conditions that will be imposed on Poland. I know for Germans especially, giving up the mark was a rather traumatic and continues to be a much more traumatic experience. But the zloty, the Polish currency, has been changed. I remember when I first went to Poland, they had gone through hyperinflation, so the currency had all these zeros on it. Then they, you know, got rid of all that currency and reduced the zeros. So the Polish population in the last 10 years has gone through different currency issues. So they're used to seeing their money change. And if it has a euro backing on it, I think in many ways they would even be more comfortable with their currency. The problem for Poland is going to be agriculture. Poland has still about 2 million people employed in the countryside. The agricultural sector is still a substantial part of the economy. This is in direct competition with the agricultural interests of countries like France, Italy, and Spain, Portugal as well to a lesser extent. These are countries that are less than keen on allowing in Poland because they do not want to have to compete with a Polish agricultural imports, nor do they want to readjust the current subsidies that the EU maintains for, let's say, French farmers and include the Polish farmers into this system of subsidized agriculture. That would be including an enormous percentage of the population in Poland, and the EU simply cannot do it. But rather than reform their own system of subsidies, the EU is still stumbling along, saying, well, you know, Poland has to reduce its agricultural sector. Poland will have to accept less subsidies. Poland will have to be a second-class member of the EU in order to kind of finally get the French and Italians to agree. Now, agriculture for Poland is something quite special, just as it is for France. And so this is where the national traditions in Poland are really going to be a point of reference in the debate over the growing debate over costs and benefits to the European Union membership. Just as the French are attached to their countryside, are attached to their cheeses and wines, and have a kind of romantic sense of France being in the countryside as opposed to being in the urban communities, so too do the Poles. Their agriculture, their farming, it's very important to them. And if we just recall the trauma with which American farms were, family farms were given up in this country, the trauma in Poland is going to be ever so much greater because a larger percentage of the population is involved. And if this is a contingency for European Union membership, it's going to cause some severe doubts in Poland.
Other questions? Yes, John?
Many, many problems between the intellectuals and the workers. Are there evidences today that these are being dispelled and that the leadership is being equalized between, let's say, a younger group of growing intellectuals and workers and the old ones taking a more backseat?
You know, that... It depends where you look. There's evidence on both parts of that. There's evidence to indicate that the suspicions of workers, you know, that workers are simply inadequate to hold public office, that workers are not capable of performing public duties, those suspicions still exist. And they explain in large part Lech Wałęsa's electoral defeat. A majority of Poles, including non-intellectuals, including workers, thought that Wałęsa was simply too much of a rube, that he was not adequately representing Poland abroad, and that his lack of foreign language skills, his kind of brusqueness, all of the things that we completely found charming. I mean, when Wałęsa came to this country, there was never any problem. But in Poland, every single utterance, every misstep that he made was framed in this notion that he was simply inadequate, as a worker, simply inadequate to hold this position. And that is still a real prevalent aspect of Polish political culture. On the other hand, you do see, as you say, a younger generation of people who are perhaps, you know, more have a greater interaction, you know, greater interaction between workers or worker families, intellectual families, who are a little bit more liberal in that sense, but a little bit more inclusive. And we'll have to see whether that tendency can outweigh the former. My suspicion is that all of this will rest on whether or not Poland can reform its educational system. Right now, it has an educational system that is very much like that of Western Europe. In other words, university training is pretty much limited to the children of the intelligentsia to begin with. You have to come from a family of means in order to get into the university, even though university is nominally free. But to pass the tests, the entry exams, you have to have come from a family that encouraged you to study, to learn. And you have to come from a family that can pay for tutors and all these other, pay for the books and your clothing, and pay for you to live in Warsaw or some other university center. If Poland can, let's say, democratize its system of higher education in particular, then you will see subsequent generations overcoming the gap between intellectuals and workers, or aristocracy and commoners. But if they don't reform their system, if they leave it on the German and French model, then just like these countries are bifurcated between an elite that is deemed to be the governing class and the rest of society that simply passively allows itself to be governed, that will be replicated in Poland, along with the old historical overlays about, you know, being a worker is somehow being inadequate.
I believe we've come to an end. One more question.
Just you already addressed, I was going to ask about the education system. Is it national? And with their propensity currently for local activism, if it is national, are the locals entering into a process to change?
It is a system that is nationally kind of administered, but has many university centers throughout. I mean, the good news is that Poland has many university centers. It's not quite as centralized as France, for example, where if you don't get into one of the Paris universities, you're just done for. In Poland, if you don't get into Warsaw, Kraków is a very, Jagiellonian University is a very prestigious university. The Catholic Church maintains universities that are private, you know, not under the government's control, for example, in Lublin. So there are many university centers that people can go to, closer to home perhaps, more manageable in terms of cost. So that distribution is a very positive one. What is less positive is the extent to which it is a nationalized system in that the state has to centrally distribute funds. And if the communities can get more freedom, get more funding to be locally administered, that would be certainly a step perhaps in democratizing the system. There has recently been a reform of local governments in Poland, and I think there are also some, I know that there are provisions in this reform to allow communities to raise their own finances. And they can certainly use some of these finances to, for primary education in their communities. And that would even be a good stepping stone. If you can improve the quality of primary schools for all your citizens, then you have a greater chance of getting access for all citizens to higher education.
I had a little note in the introduction that our speaker was a rising star. I think those of you who have heard her today would agree she's already risen.
So thank you.
We're privileged to have her, and look forward to
thank
many
you.
Presentations.